this section of line 26 through 34 addressed only mediation, then there's a couple of, let's see, something on the line 29. In addition to all, shall collect, in addition to all other fees collected, start scratching everything out after that, an amount determined by the governing board of the county to be necessary to pay the expenses of providing mediation services.
Mr. Chairman, the current conciliation laws are, it's not mandatory conciliation, it's only if one party requests it. Mm-hmm. Petitions for conciliation, so I would think that even under the current conciliation services, there are, I don't know how many, but many, many dissolution cases do not go through conciliation, but they're still charged a $75 fee. And I would think it'd be, in fact, there was testimony that mediation would involve most, if not all, most domestic relations cases will involve a child custody or child visitation issue, or very many of them will, and mediation will be mandatory for them. So it might, I would be surprised if $75 would be too much of a fee to charge, even though some couples don't use it. It would be very similar to the current situation with conciliation.
If they don't have children, they probably wouldn't have mediation. Or any childless couples. I don't have a specific motion to resolve what I perceive as a potential problem. I think we might discourage this program in certain counties, and we also might be encouraged in that.
I'm not sure in advance of the fact we can really know.
Mm-hmm.
It may take, assuming the bill becomes law, it may take a couple of years' experience to find out
how this fee is working.
I would share the sense that mediation is likely to be at least as expensive, and will probably be involved in a larger proportion of the cases than conciliation, if it is imposed by the district.
Well, I'm prepared to support this bill.
Further discussion of Representative Courtney's motion. Call the roll.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Scavero?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
Approved. House Bill 2367.
House Bill 2367 is also a Commission on Judicial Branch bill. It establishes a reference judge program, modeled in part after the program in California. The reference judge program allows Chief Justice to establish a panel of reference judges or referees. This would only be for civil actions, and the reference judges would only be used where the parties in a lawsuit decided that they wanted it and were willing to pay for the services of the reference judge. Otherwise, it'll be the trial held by the reference judge will follow all the normal civil court trial procedures. There's no provision for it to be a jury trial. The compensation for the reference judges would be limited, although the committee did amend that portion of the statute, and in the absence of other agreement would parallel the daily rate of compensation paid to circuit judges. The costs are to be split equally between the parties in a reference judge proceeding unless they otherwise agree. And a judgment by a reference judge would be docketed like any other judgment and could be appealed like any other judgment. The subcommittee heard testimony on the bill on January 25th and again held a work session, and I think heard limited testimony on March 1st. The bill was amended in three fairly minor ways. On page 1 of the bill at line 10, the bill as originally printed had stated that a person is eligible for appointment as a reference judge if the person is a member of the Oregon State Bar or a retired judge of a circuit court in this state. There was some discussion that it was probable that any retired judge would still be a member of the Oregon State Bar, and that just limiting it to a retired judge of a circuit court of the state might be unduly restrictive, that if the parties wanted to pick a retired district court judge or JP judge, that that was up to them. So the committee took out the words, or a retired judge of a circuit court in this state, making the only requirement that be that they are a member of the Oregon State Bar. Representative Smith then moved to add the words, in good standing, so that they had to be a member in good standing of the Oregon State Bar, and the committee accepted that. I subsequently called the State Bar to confirm, at Representative Smith's request, to confirm that the phrase in good standing is a phrase that's well understood at the bar, and it is well understood there. When an attorney leaves Oregon to practice in another jurisdiction, the bar frequently gets requests from the Bar Association of the other jurisdictions to provide a statement of good standing about that lawyer. And the statement of good standing is, well, the request is referred to the bar's legal counsel, who then looks through the file on that attorney and checks to see if there's any, I don't know if they just check for pending disciplinary actions or past ones, but in any case, the phrase good standing does have the meaning that the subcommittee wanted it to have. So that line now would read that a person is eligible for appointment as a reference judge if the person is a member in good standing of the Oregon State Bar. The only other amendment was on page 3 of the bill, lines 32-33. That section 5 of the bill presently limits the compensation to be paid to a reference judge to the same daily rate as is paid to a sitting circuit court judge. Testimony received at hearing said that that was necessary to prevent morale problems among sitting judges who see their former brethren and other attorneys making more money than they are by sitting as reference judges. However, the bill as originally printed did allow a higher rate of compensation to be paid if the presiding judge of the circuit court approved the higher rate, and that was anticipated to be in particularly complex cases and areas where expertise was involved, such as patent law or antitrust law. The committee discussed this matter and decided that there really was no reason not to let the parties agree to whatever rate of compensation they chose, so that they deleted the words, and approved by the presiding judge of the circuit court, from Section 5, so that now the parties can agree to whatever fee they want to pay the reference judge, but in the absence of an agreement, the reference judges will be paid the same compensation, daily compensation, as a circuit court judge. And those were all the amendments.
Is there a motion to report the bill as amended?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lombard moves to report House Bill 2367 as amended by the subcommittee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Tavera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Webster?
Excuse.
Representative
Myers? Aye. Approved. House Bill 2368.
At the start of this meeting, I received a letter from the Oregon Remodelers Association supporting the bill, and I'll distribute their copies later on. I also received a note that the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon, the Independent Plumbing Contractors of Oregon, and the Affiliated Rental Housing Association also would like to go on record supporting the bill. This bill has a pretty simple history. All the bill does is increases the small claims jurisdiction in the district courts from $700 to $1,000. It doesn't change. There was some talk about, at the same time, raising the level necessary before a party has a right to a jury trial. It's presently at $200. However, there was some concern that the constitutional guarantee of jury trial in civil cases over, I think it's $25, might be a barrier. I don't quite know why the $200 level is okay, but for that reason there was no decision to raise it above $200. There are some other changes and amendments proposed to small claims court procedures and to district court procedures. when claims are removed from small claims jurisdiction to the regular district court jurisdiction. These are all in the LC drafting stage at present, and so after consulting with the chair, there was a decision made to defer those other changes to House Bill 2502, which is identical to House Bill 2368, and so it can be used as a vehicle at a later time for these other proposed changes to the small claims courts and the district courts. The bill was recommended as due pass without any amendments.
Is there a motion?
I move.
Representative Courtney moves to report House Bill 2368 with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Smith.
Just would like the record to note that I've received correspondence and a telephone call from Alan Marash, who's the Vice President of Blue Ribbon Foods in Portland, and they would like to go on record as supporting the bill as it stands.
And I'll stress again.
Sounds like it, you know.
I'll stress again to the committee that we do have other law improvement kinds of proposals dealing with small claims that we will be asking the subcommittee to address in relation to the other bill. But we thought we'd advance this portion as presented because it is part of the commission package. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Rutherford?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Savera?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Chairman Myers?
Aye. Approved.
Mr. Council Chairman. Representative Smith, just a comment on 2368. It would be helpful to me personally, and I think whoever has to carry that bill, to have a quick briefing by council on the constitutional issue and how it is Oregon has dealt with that. Something a lawyer on the floor of the House ought to be able to explain.
This bill came from the Court Enforcement Division, I believe, of the Department of Justice. A public hearing was held on February 1st, and a work session with additional testimony was held on February 17th. The bill amends a number of provisions regarding support enforcement for public assistance recipients. Among other things, the bill allows the Department of Human Resources to initiate proceedings for child support in any case in which the department is providing public assistance for a dependent child. So it allows the department to step in, if you will, into the place of the parent who is entitled to receive public assistance to try to initiate proceedings, and there are other parts of the law that allows the Support Enforcement Division to collect, I believe, allows them to collect whatever support is collected to offset the public assistance for the dependent child. The bill also provides that in support enforcement proceedings, a computer printout can be offered as prima facie evidence that public assistance is being paid. Under present law, it sometimes is difficult for the department has to bring in an employee to testify that this is a business record, and it does show that the particular person that the department is representing has been receiving public assistance. This would follow parallel the Motor Vehicles Division statutes allowing a kind of a certified copy to be submitted instead of having a someone come in and testify that it's a business record. The bill as originally drafted contained a provision stating that the simple payment of public assistance will constitute sufficient change of circumstances to justify a modification of a prior support order. I'll get to that in a minute, but the committee voted to delete that from the bill. Finally, the bill provides that payment of public assistance for child support automatically transfers any support rights the child may have to the Department of Human Resources for enforcement. That last amendment, I believe, simply simplifies the procedure by which the department can step in when it's paying support for a dependent child. Simplifies the procedure by which the department can then go in after the spouse that owes public support and try to collect back some of the money that the Department of Human Resources has paid on behalf of the dependent child. The committee amended the bill by deleting, as I mentioned, deleting Section 5 of the bill, which would have held that payment of public support in and of itself was sufficient change of circumstance to justify modification of the support enforcement. The committee felt that there might be other factors involved, and at first considered saying that payment of public assistance would be a factor or would be evidence of a change of circumstance to justify modification. And after further discussion, it was decided that's what the law is right now, that it would be evidence. So on that basis, Section 5 was deleted entirely. Section 4 of the bill was amended at the request of the subcommittee. The problem with Section 4 as originally written was in part that it was rather vague as to how the computer printout could be introduced as prima facie evidence of payment of public assistance. The committee requested Larry Young of the Department of Justice to come up with an amendment that was modeled after the Department of Motor Vehicles language, and he did submit a proposed amendment, which I modified in one minor respect, and which I think has been distributed to all the members. It would create a new Section 3 in place of the existing Section 3 and 4 to read, in any proceeding to establish, enforce, or modify a support obligation, comma, extrinsic evidence of authenticity is not required as a condition precedent to the admission of a Department of Human Resources computer printout, which may reflect the payment of public assistance, comma, the amounts paid, the period during which public assistance was paid, persons receiving or having received assistance, and any other pertinent information, if the printout bears a seal purporting to be that of the department and is certified as a true copy by original or facsimile signature of a person purporting to be an officer or employee of the department. Printouts certified in accordance with this section constitute prima facie evidence of the existence of the facts stated therein. That is modeled almost exactly after the Motor Vehicles Division statement, part of the statute about introduction of certain of their records in a case. And I would point out that it only is prima facie evidence. If the other party thought there was something wrong with it, they could introduce other evidence to try to combat it or to say that it was incorrect. With that amendment and with the deletion of Section 5, the committee voted the bill to do pass as amended.
Now, what was the change you made to the amendment as submitted by the department? Is that the language that's stricken out?
Yes.
Or the new language written in on
yes.
this draft?
Yes. The original language was that it could show the dates the assistance grant was open, and I thought that was unclear what that meant, and I confirmed with Larry Young that to say that an assistance grant is open means that it's the period during which public assistance was paid.
Now, this amendment, as modified by you, was adopted by the subcommittee?
I don't believe so. I think the subcommittee has
to move it forward.
Chair would move the adoption of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2260 as distributed to the members.
Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
Question on form and style. In the old amendments, we had made this provision a part of ORS Chapter 416. The way these amendments are printed, we do not give any direction to legislative council as to the placement of this new Section 3. And I know that the amendments that came over from the Department of Justice that Larry prepared omitted that. I'm wondering if that was an oversight, and if so, should we begin our deletion on line 10 and amend line 9 to simply provide that Section 4 is added to and made a part of ORS Chapter 416?
Can you address that question, Mr. Hall?
I've looked at Mr. Young, and he's indicated that that's fine with him. So
416.
It doesn't matter which way it is.
That's where it'll go, I assume.
The reason I took out the language relating to 416 was because I wanted to leave it to legislative council to put it where they want it. There are a number of support enforcement statutes scattered in Chapter 23, Chapters 106, 107.
Okay.
Well, I don't care.
Should we just leave it then and let them decide?
Strong letter to follow, perhaps?
All right, so the amendments then as proposed would include that deletion, and that would be less than passed.
Stick it in the code.
Is there further discussion of the amendments as distributed? Is there any objection to their adoption? Motion on the bill as amended?
So move.
President Courtney moves House Bill 2260 as amended to be reported with a due pass recommendation. discussion?
Representatives Portman?
Yes.
Keller?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Tavera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Schreiber?
Aye.
Ruppert?
Aye.
Vaughn Meyer?
Aye.
This bill also comes from the Support Enforcement Division in the Department of Justice and is intended to clear up some areas in the paternity laws. The first three sections of the bill provide some new technical definitions and provide that paternity cases will be governed by the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. Section 4 allows evidence establishing paternity to be presented by affidavit. Section 7 and 8, as originally drafted, allowed the court to require the posting of bond to cover the costs of a blood test and to allow the court to resolve the issue of paternity against any person who refused to post a bond. Section 9 of the bill was a change to some of the vital statistics statutes, which has been deleted from the bill, as I'll mention in a moment. The committee held a public hearing on the bill on February 1st and held a work session on February 17th. The committee subcommittee voted to amend the bill on page 4 in several respects. At lines 8 and 9 on page 4, the committee voted to delete the words "or refuses to post any bond required by the court." That's in section 7 of the bill. So they removed the proposed power of the court to decide paternity against someone simply because he refused to post a bond for a blood test. In section 8 of the bill, the committee voted to delete the language at lines 13 and 14, which read, "The court may order any party who is not indigent to post bond to ensure payment of blood test costs." That also was removed in part on the idea that that might be a little, that and the section 7 might be a little bit of overkill. Section 9 of the bill was removed entirely upon agreement of the Department of Justice and the vital statistics people, because they have another bill that will accomplish the same thing in a more comprehensive fashion. And then at the last line, section 10 of the bill is amended to read section 9 of the bill.
All the amendments you described were adopted in final form in the subcommittee?
I believe they were, yes. Yes. They since have been embodied in the, I think this has been distributed, that proposed amendments drafted by legislative council, which parallel what I just mentioned.
I just want to be sure there wasn't something left conceptually that we need formally to act on, separate from the bill itself.
Not on this.
Is there a motion on House Bill 2261 as amended? Representative Rutherford moves House Bill 2261 be reported with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Question.
Mr. Smith.
Line 30, section 10, on the last page, I think I may have asked this at the subcommittee. I need to be refreshed on what we're repealing there. 109.153. Maybe, Kirk, do you know that?
What was the reference again?
The very last line of the entire bill, I want to know what we're repealing. Can Mr. Young quickly advise us on that, Mr. Chairman?
He's looking for it now.
Cool.
Mr. Chairman, 109.153 was...
You better come up and identify yourself so we can get you on the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Lawrence Young for the Department of Justice. ORS 109.153 was a definition of child attending school. In the first section of the bill, I created a definitions section for the paternity statutes in general, and subsection 1 of ORS 109.124 would reincorporate the language contained in 109.153. With no substantive change.
That's lines 7 through 11 on page 1 are virtually the same as 109.153, which is being deleted.
Thank you. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Aye.
Smith? Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
Approved.
approve House Bill 2306.
This bill is presented by the, at the request of the Oregon State Bar. It amends the present statute governing attorney's fees on appeals where the prevailing party is entitled to attorney's fees by contract. Under present law, the prevailing party is defined as the party in whose favor final judgment is rendered. In some cases, this can mean that a defendant is required to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees on appeal, even though the lower court judgment against the defendant is substantially reduced on appeal. In other words, a defendant who loses $1 million in trial and cuts it back to $100 on appeal is still required to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees because the plaintiff was still the prevailing party technically on the appeal, still had won $100. This bill would modify the definition of a prevailing party on appeal so that it could include, at the court's discretion, any party who obtains a substantial modification of the trial court judgment. Now, after the hearing was held on February 15th, and Mr. Norman Winslow spoke on behalf of the bar and on behalf of this bill, I have some questions about what happened when there were two appeals, one to the Court of Appeals and a second then to the Supreme Court, where the Court of Appeals cut back a plaintiff's judgment considerably and the Supreme Court restored it in part. Who was the prevailing party on the bill as presently reads would define, allow the court to define the prevailing party as anyone who obtained a substantial modification of the trial court judgment. And I was concerned about if you won a substantial modification of the last appellate court judgment, would you be left out? Would you not, that it, was that or was not that the appellate court judgment considered to be the trial court judgment under the statute? And the case that I posited was where a plaintiff wins $1 million at trial, it's cut back to 100 on three causes of action, it's cut back to one cause of action or $100,000 by the Court of Appeals, and it's restored to two causes of action or $500,000 by the Supreme Court. My concern was that even though in the second appeal from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, even though the plaintiff basically won at that stage, increasing what the plaintiff was entitled to recover, because the final judgment as left by the Supreme Court was less than the original trial court judgment, I was concerned that this definition might give attorney's fees to the wrong party, the party who actually lost at that second appeal level. I wrote Mr. Winslow and asked him to clarify that point for me if he could, with the intention that my letter and his letter be introduced into the record, and he has written back, and his basic answer is that he thinks the intent of the bill is to allow in this case, the Supreme Court to make its own determination of who's the prevailing party so that they wouldn't be locked into the problem that I raised, that they would be able to decide in that case who really had succeeded, and that they would also have the power to wipe out any award of attorney's fees made at the Court of Appeals stage if they substantially reduced what the Court of Appeals did. So I'm satisfied now that the bill, with this introduced as legislative history, that the bill will do what everybody really wants it to do, which is to give the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court the power to give attorney's fees to the whatever party really has prevailed in the appeal. I'll pass the letter out at this point and answer any questions on it, but I would propose, if it's all right with the committee, to introduce it as part of the legislative record.
Is a question appropriate, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Smith, would this legislation prevent parties to a contract from agreeing on a different definition of prevailing party or specifying prevailing party? Or would it leave discretion ultimately in the court? Certain people that I've represented now are growing very, very cautious about how they draft these things, and they're putting in actual attorney's fees instead of reasonable. They're doing a number of things in their contracts, and it seems to me they're trying to reach a specific conclusion. Would that contract force the Supreme Court to exercise its discretion in favor of the clear intent of the contract?
This bill makes a very narrow amendment to the attorney's fees on appeal statute, so let me look quickly at the rest of the statute. This bill would not really, as I see it, would not really affect that issue at all. It simply allows the court, essentially allows the court to get around what is presently a curious and probably wrong straitjacket as to who can be the prevailing party on an appeal. So let me look at the statute just a moment. Well, I would say, just looking at the bill, which reprints ORS 20.096 sub 1, as it's written now, it says, in any action or suit on a contract where such contract specifically provides that attorney's fees and costs shall be awarded, the prevailing party shall be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees. You could read that right now as not necessarily allowing the parties to supersede that by contract. That issue is not really
a separate issue, apparently, but I guess it's one I'd feel better if it were clarified, because more often now we are drawing documents for people that say prevailing party shall receive.
Passed out a hand-engrossed copy of the version of the bill with amendments that's adopted by the subcommittee. The bill as amended clarifies the authority to require payment or to waive probation supervision fees. It also clarifies the responsibility for collecting these fees as well as the right to retain them. Existing law provides that any person placed on parole, probation, or other release who is supervised by Corrections Division or Community Corrections Program is required to pay a monthly fee to offset the costs of that supervision. The new subsection 2 merely provides that anyone presently or in the future who is not supervised under these programs may be required to pay a fee to offset the cost of their supervision as well. The new subsection 4, which begins at line 10 and continues on to the second page, establishes that whatever entity actually supervises the individual is responsible for collecting the supervision fee, and that same agency retains the fee. If anyone needs further clarification, I can explain how that works in various scenarios under the Community Corrections Act and that side. There is one, the other major change of the bill is at the bottom of page 2. Existing law permits the supervising agency to waive supervision fees. As amended, the agency also would be able subsequently to restore the fee requirement in part or in whole. In addition, the court is given the authority to waive or restore the fee requirement as well. And if the court has waived the requirement, only the court would be permitted to restore it. There has been one other amendment since the subcommittee acted, that was requested by Paul Snyder. And what he has requested is that the counties be given the same authority to provide for collection of supervision fees by contract as is given to the Corrections Division. And that would be located on page 2 of the Hanegro's version. If you'll note in the new subsection B, it provides that if the person is supervised by the Corrections Division, that the division shall collect or provide by contract for the collection of the fee. What he's basically asked for is the same ability by the county to collect or to provide by contract for the collection of the fee. And that language would be inserted in the second line of the new sub A after the word collect. You would add in or provide by contract for the collection of. I'd also note that
the chair would move the further amendment Page 2, line 2 of the Hannon Gross version, after the word collect, insert or provide by contract for the collection of. Is there any discussion? Objection? Approved. Go ahead.
I would just further note that at the chair's request, I reviewed this bill with, or what we were doing in this bill with the fiscal office, and asked about the need for a subsequent referral. I did talk to Dan Simmons down there, who said that it probably would double the amount that the corrections division now gets, which is approximately $96,000, and said that if it were sent to Ways and Means, they could work this fiscal impact into their budget.
As I interpreted the discussion we had with fiscal, there was a request that they do have the opportunity to receive the bill in connection with the total corrections division budget. Is there further discussion of the amendments as amended, or the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair?
Jim Miller?
On page 2, it appears here where it starts renumbering line 1 for the second time. We talk about in cases of financial hardship and when otherwise advisable, in the interest of the released person's rehabilitation, and then we talk about you can waive that payment or subsequently restore it, and I just find it unusual maybe to subsequently restore a payment in light of financial hardship. Maybe we can phrase that lead sentence better, just to say when advisable in the interest of the released person's rehabilitation. Those two somehow don't go together to me.
Hate to slow down the process.
That's right.
Representative,
would you state your point again, Mr. Law?
Well, when we're the description there of who's going to apply for maybe the waiver of the payment, there's a reference to if there's financial hardship or when otherwise advisable, and I just think that maybe we could eliminate perhaps financial hardship or something, but when you talk about restoring the payment, I doubt if it's going to be in a case where there is financial hardship.
I think it
would say when otherwise or when advisable.
By whom?
That's pretty loose, maybe.
Well, judgment, I make decisions.
Oh, glad of it.
Judgment, really, wouldn't he? This is advisory.
I think your point's valid. I'm just trying to see how best we might express it by way of the rule. Right. I think in subsection A, what we might do there is take out the or subsequent restore language as part of that sentence and perhaps go on to construct a second sentence which contains the authorization to subsequently restore the fee.
Mr. Chairman, an alternative might be to take the words in cases of financial hardship and put it down, say may waive in cases of financial hardship or may subsequently restore. I think Representative Miller, his objection was having in cases of financial hardship.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Your suggestion, Mr. Hall, is to put that introductory language in the text
after the word waive.
Oh.
May waive and in cases of financial hardship, I suppose, or may subsequently restore the payment. It's not particularly elegant, but at least it would keep waived together with cases of financial hardship.
Mr. Chair, would the chair want to consider a conceptual amendment to restructure the subsection that I would submit to members before the bill is reported to the floor? I guess I'm just uncomfortable about trying to restructure this on the spot in a way that's going to end up...
Let's hold it over. There's no motion. Sort of like an act of a bill today. Would the members be agreeable to a conceptual amendment with the text distributed prior to the filing of the committee report? Well, no, we're not going to have, we've got to have the exact text, I think, before us to act on it.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
So, I can't withdraw my idea.
It's too good an idea.
Great call, isn't it?
House Bill 2088.
I don't want to carry this bill.
Is being distributed to you in a hand engrossed form. It was sent to pass as amended to the full committee by sub 1 with the recommendation that be referred to Ways and Means. As amended, the bill replaces the existing gate money provisions under which an inmate receives up to $100 upon release from the corrections division. In its place are provisions allowing the corrections division to disperse monies under a release subsidies program in which the division would be better able to direct monies as needed. As in the gate money program, the division would offset against the subsidies any monies that the inmate has been able to accumulate while in the facility. The amendments also allow the corrections division to adopt rules to assess inmates for programs provided by the division when the inmate has monies to pay for them, to allow inmates to purchase elective programs that are approved by but not provided by the division, and to assess inmates for damages that the inmate causes by willful misconduct. Subsection 3 of the proposed amendments provides that an inmate released from the corrections division has 90 days following release to apply for release funds. There are some proposed amendments to the amendments that were adopted by the subcommittee, which I can explain as follows. The first is following line 11 of the printed LC amendments. The purpose here is to clarify that the rules will be adopted to provide both for the safeguarding of inmate monies and for the disbursement of those monies, as well as the release funds. The amendment after the amendments in lines 12 through 15 are basically a restructuring of the sentence and a clarification that rules should be established for the release fund program in general terms. The amendment after line 27 is in response to a concern that was raised by Jim Russell in the governor's office. The intent of subsection 3 was to cover in this program those who are released to another detainer in this state and who then are subsequently released in Oregon. However, Mr. Russell pointed out that inmates are released to local authorities while they are awaiting and are under a detainer for transfer to another state. And that is what the sentence the first new sentence that's proposed after line 27 is to address that. The last sentence is to clarify that in order to remain eligible for release funds, anyone who's been released to another detainer must be released from that imprisonment within the time period in order to apply for release funds.
And as I was reviewing the amendments a moment ago, in subsection A, it speaks of safeguarding inmate monies, etc., and to provide for disbursement of such monies, and then it says, and other release funds provided pursuant to paragraph B. In paragraph B, it says, establish, within appropriations provided, etc., the program of release funds to be provided for those inmates. I'm wondering if that part of sub A talking about disbursement of other release funds isn't subsumed within sub B anyway, and that sub A could simply be confined to disbursement of the inmate's own money.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's possible to do that. I think my...
You see what I'm asking?
Yes. That my... It was very, I was being real picky about the sub B, which said that the Corrections Division would adopt rules to establish the program, now it would be rephrased, the program of release funds to be provided, and it was, I guess I was just wanting to put in a specific language that said that there would be rules to provide for the disbursement, but I do think it could be covered under subsection B, and it's probably unnecessary. It was just sort of an extra.
I would think that if rules governing rules establishing the program of release funds would necessarily have to include the disbursement of those funds. So the chair would move that in subsection A, following line 11, the amendments be further amended to delete and other release funds provided pursuant to paragraph B of this subsection. So the language remaining would be, starting after line 11, and to provide for disbursement of such monies to the inmate following the inmate's release from the prison. So subsection A will only relate to the inmate's own money. Then sub B, program of release funds. Is there discussion of the amendment? Is there objection? Now, certain refinements of these amendments have occurred since the subcommittee. I think, to be safe, I'll simply move the proposed amendments as amended and as distributed to the members of the committee. Is there any objection, discussion, or objection? Is there a motion on House Bill 2088 as amended? Now this has, it carried with it a recommendation that it be subsequently referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The reason being that the abolition of the gate money program, in the view of the subcommittee and of the Corrections Division, should hinge on the willingness of the Ways and Means Committee to collapse the gate money fund into the larger release subsidy program, which is a separate element within the Corrections Division budget. So if, for whatever reason, the committee, Ways and Means Committee, were not willing to do that, then as I understand, it's the Corrections Division preference that the gate money program continues. So this has got to be dovetailed into Ways and Means action in shaping the final Corrections Division budget. Is there a motion to report the bill as amended, do pass with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means?
So moved.
Senator Courtney, so moves. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Ms. Rutherford?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Stelvera?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Aye.
Are we on 2446? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this bill was passed to the full committee by Subcommittee 1, and passed as amended. The bill as amended provides that whatever law enforcement agency seizes boats, fishing gear, or vehicles used in violation of commercial fishing laws or rules shall retain custody of the property. It also provides that the law enforcement agency storing the property may recover its storage costs for forfeited property from proceeds from the sale of such property. It basically addresses the problem of the burden and costs to sheriffs due to the present requirement that all property seized for violation of commercial fishing laws be turned over to sheriffs in the county where it's seized. And the committee amended the bill to provide that rather than require the Fish and Wildlife Commission to store the seized property, that it would be retained by the law enforcement agency that makes the seizure.
Bill as amended is identical to the bill reported last session by the committee.
Yes, please.
What was the subsequent history? Did we report it out of the full committee to the floor?
Passed the House, I believe.
55-3 on the House floor. It was tabled by rule and Senate Justice Committee.
Well, it was those three votes that brought the whole deja vu. Is there a motion on the bill as amended? Representative Lombard.
I would move the bill as amended and forward the best recommendation.
Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I would add parenthetically that Linda spent an undue amount of time at my request to try to figure out how to require the violators to pay for the cost of storage, and we determined that it was the judges, apparently. They had the power and weren't requiring it. I asked her to draft amendments to require the placement of all vessels on the judges' lawns. That didn't go over very far. We didn't have enough time to prepare the amendment, so we'll catch it in the Senate.
We'll catch it all. Is there a further discussion?
Yes.
Hill.
Aye.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Delbert.
Aye.
Rutherford.
Aye.
Chairman Meyer.
Aye.
Dr. House Bill 2450.
Mr. Chair, I distributed a marked up version of House Bill 2450. The bill was sent due pass to the full committee by Subcommittee 1, subject to any technical amendments in the language which may be needed. And the amendments that are indicated in the markup would be such technical amendments that I propose and have discussed with Legislative Council. The purpose of the bill is to resolve the problems that have been presented by state and local law enforcement agencies being involved in enforcing federal immigration laws. Its intent is to clarify in the Oregon statutes the status of existing law, that is, that state and local law enforcement agencies may not expend their monies or personnel to detect or apprehend persons whose only offense is residing here in violation of federal immigration laws. Federal law specifically delegates enforcement of immigration laws, which are civil violations, to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The amendments that are suggested for clarification that you'll note in line 4, actually what generated my suggestion of this amendment was a call initially from the Adult and Family Services, who said that under the food stamp requirements, the federal regulations require them, if it comes to their attention, the person applying for food stamps, for example, that the person is an illegal alien, that they report that. And I think that their concern that this may conflict with their requirements to report was the absence of the word of, and that the intent of the bill was to indicate that no law enforcement agency of the state or law enforcement agency of any political subdivision of the state is to use its monies in enforcing these immigration laws. The amendment on line 5 is merely a language preference. It's not intended to make any sort of substantive change in the language in that presently in the bill.
Chair would move the adoption of the amendments as distributed to the committee. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, this is the time for general discussion. This bill is a committee bill at the request of the Hispanic Political Action Committee. Was a case made for the need for the bill in subcommittee? What is the problem that we are solving?
Then would you like to recap the testimony or any other members?
I think Linda may recall, it's my recollection, I had talked with representatives of the HPAC who appeared, testified, and are here today. Basically, the problem occurs some jurisdictions apparently notwithstanding what is case law, as we had explained to us, pursuant to a consent decree, for reasons best known to themselves, are still apparently assuming some responsibility to assist Immigration and Naturalization Service officers in the enforcement of this federal civil statute. And I can't say why they're doing it, but apparently they are. It was felt by HPAC and the testimony that a specific prohibition in our statutes would be necessary so that those few law enforcement agencies that apparently are voluntarily doing this would understand that it is, that kind of conduct is prohibited by statute.
You refer to a consent decree. Can you refresh me again on that?
Linda, I think, has a, I may have a copy of it in my file as well, but I think council had a copy of a, it's in Oregon. Apparently there were several lawsuits regarding that, and Rockies and Korea prepared a letter to the subcommittee dated February 14th indicated that he prevailed in such a case. It was Trevino versus the City of Independence Police and Polk County Sheriffs from 1977. And apparently that's the state of the law at this time.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I could add a few comments from a conversation I had this morning with the Deputy General Counsel for Immigration Naturalization Service today, who is located, his name is Paul Schmidt, he's located in Washington, D.C., and he stated to me that they're, confirming what was stated by the proponents of the bill, that there is no authority to delegate down authority for civil immigration, enforcement civil immigration laws to local officials, and he affirmed that they do not see local law enforcement people as an extension of the Immigration Naturalization Service, and it is not their policy to have locals enforce the civil immigration laws. And I asked him if he felt that there was any problem thereby presented by the language of the bill that was in conflict, that he thought presented a problem, and he said he did not believe so.
So if I could summarize that, then I take it that besides the consent decree, there is INS agreement that local and state officials should not be in the business of, as I gather, stopping and questioning persons as to their immigration status, and that it is a civil matter and that there's no criminal matter involved here. The complaint, I gather, by those who are being stopped is simply that local law enforcement officials don't have authority to
determine immigration status, but it's really none of their business. It could be only for harassment purposes.
I believe that's
fair. That's a fair statement. I think that the concern and the problems which have arisen in the past, which led to the consent decree, apparently are still a source of some problem, even as recently as within the past year or two.
The statute recaps essentially the position, as I understand it, which is reflected in the Immigration and Naturalization Act itself, as interpreted by the United States Attorney General, by Oregon Attorney General Redden, opinion number 7439, and various court decisions, one of which has been mentioned.
Well, I believe that the background was by way of discussion of your motion on the amendments. I have no objection to the amendments.
Is there any discussion of the motion to adopt the amendments as distributed by counsel? Is there any objection? Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
So moved.
Representative Hill moves that House Bill 2450 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor this, but if I may, a gentleman by the name of Clark Hill from Hillsborough has written to me, and I question whether he's written other members of the committee about his concerns about the bill. I having this background now, I think I can juxtapose his concerns with the purpose behind the bill, but Mr. Hill's daughter was killed by a drunk driver. The drunk driver turned out to be an illegal alien, and he strongly opposes this legislation on the theory that local law enforcement officials ought to participate in seeing the illegal aliens are not here, let alone doing injustice to local citizens. And his feelings were rather intense, and I had assumed by now he probably contacted every member of the committee. But I think for purposes of the record, I'd like people here to know of his concerns about the bill.
He wishes local law enforcement to be involved in the enforcement of the immigration laws.
Right, but I think he does not appreciate, nor did I until just now, the effect of the consent decree or the INS's own position on this matter.
Further discussion? Call the roll.
Representatives Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Avera?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Seven Myers?
Aye.
2415.
Yeah.